The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Welcome back to the Dan Prof Show. Our next guest terms reopen America, the getting back to work, as an economic and political fantasy. Incumbent politicians, he writes, crave a true growth rebound, and the depth of collapse makes some possible attractive short-term numbers, but taking them seriously will merely set the stage for a new round of disillusion. As nationwide protests against systemic racism and police brutality show, disillusion is America's one big growth sector right now. Yeah, unfortunately, I think that last point that he makes is a good one. There's some disagreement, though, just about how structurally unsound our economy was going into the pandemic. There's not much disagreement about how much damage has the lockdowns have done. It's just a question and a discussion about the extent and the pace at which something approximating a recovery could occur. For more on this, we're pleased to be joined by the author of the piece I was referencing. He is James K. Galbraith, professor of government and chair in government and business relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the UT, University of Texas at Austin, former ED of the Joint Economic Committee and author of Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, as well as Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. Professor Galbraith, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I spoke with Steve Moore from the Journal earlier in the week, in part about your piece and some of the points you make about how America's economy has changed over the last 50 years. And so as those changes mean that it is less likely to have a rubber band snapback that some were projecting, even hoping for. But he disagrees with the implicit premise of your piece, which is that America's economy was unsound or on shaky ground going into the pandemic. Give us a more complete picture of what you thought about America's economy in terms of structural infirmities pre-pandemic, pre-lockdown.
Well, there are three things that are, I think, most troublesome. One is that the structure of many of our most advanced industries, you can think about aviation, for example, or oil field services, energy services, is oriented toward the global market. These are global investment goods. And so if you think about aircraft, half of the planes in the world are on the ground right now. Orders for new aircraft are going to be slashed, if there are any at all. If you think about oil, that's a commodity that has a global price, and it's well below the cost of production in the Permian Basin in Texas, where we have our major fracking fields these days. So you're looking at things which it's very hard for me to see how U.S. government policy can keep those industries and make those industries snap back. It depends upon world conditions, and world conditions are not favorable. So that's one piece of it. Second piece of it has to do with all the millions of jobs that have been created in the services sector, everybody taking in each other's washing, if you like, a lot of restaurants and bars and public events and all kinds of things that actually created the jobs that came back after the great financial crisis 13 years ago. And the problem there is that people basically these are things which are, to a degree, from the consumer's point of view, optional. And so there's a huge amount of saving in the system thanks to all the money that people were paid in April. But the chances that they're going to rush out and spend it, not all that great. And if they don't, then the jobs don't come back. And the third thing is debt. People have mortgages, they have rent, they have utility bills. These things have gone on even though their employment's been interrupted. And people are going to hoard funds, conserve, save in order to meet those bills first and foremost. And right now there are a lot of arrears. People are not being evicted because there's a moratorium. That all comes to end in the summer. end of the summer. So I think there's a lot of anticipatory saving going on, quite rightly. And for all these reasons, you can flush money into the system. It doesn't mean it's going to show up as a big revival in all these service jobs that we've been basically living, built up prosperity in our low rate of unemployment over the past in the past decade or so. So those are the things that are most prominent in my mind, is saying this is going to be a long, difficult problem.
Well, that's certainly the CBO's, Congressional Budget Office's view. I mean, talking about 10 years to get back to pre-pandemic rates of GDP growth, for example. But when we come back, I want to talk a little bit about what Jay Powell did and said this week that roiled the markets on Thursday, and what some of the Fed's projections about employment in particular could mean for the rate of recovery. More with Professor James K. Galbraith, Professor of Government, Chair in the Government Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. More with Professor Galbraith when we return.
Fakers, fixers, and takers. He's Dan Proft, and this is the Dan Proft Show.
Welcome back to the Dan Proft Show. We're talking the road to recovery with Professor James K. Galbraith, Professor of Government and Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Former ED of the Joint Economic Committee and author of books including Inequality, What Everyone Needs to Know, and Welcome to the Poison Chalice, The Destruction of Greece and the Future of Europe. And Professor, this week, Jay Powell saying interest rates likely to remain between 0 and 0.25% for the next couple of years, projecting out about a little over 9% unemployment, will be down to 9% unemployment by year's end. And I wonder, when you're thinking about recovery, people are talking about the unemployment number as an indication of recovery. But could we have unemployment, higher unemployment, and a real economic recovery? Businesses that have good-looking or even better-looking balance sheets, but fewer employees, and then it becomes a matter of sort of the Fortune 1000 companies versus those middle and lower income workers, and what the government may have to do to address the problems that those middle and lower income workers are going to have when forbearance and stimulus run out.
Yeah, well, I listened to Chairman Powell, and I thought he was quite candid, and I was glad he spoke when he did, because he got the blame for the stock market drop rather than me. you know, in some ways, I thought the presentation, which is basically based on these forecasting models, was not pessimistic enough. What we're seeing here is, first of all, the unemployment number, you know, and I think that Chairman Powell actually did say this, is a mask for it's people who are looking for work. A great many people will simply stop looking, and that purchasing power comes off the market. The problem that I have is that when you're looking at numbers as big as this, and we got 33 million or so who are seeking unemployment insurance at the present time, you're looking at a problem that can't wait for a few years, for till 2022 before it's addressed. You're going to have cascading social difficulties. The waves of protests that we're having now, which were animated by a very specific set of injustices, will be amplified by the economic desperation. People who begin to be thrown out of their homes are going to say, what did I do wrong? I did what I was told. I stayed home to fight the pandemic, and I'm losing my living space. I'm losing my family safety. People are going to be very, very angry over that. So I think one needs to really think in terms of kind of big transformations that will try and provide people with a measure of safety that they don't have now. That will be the foundation for rebuilding the economy. And then you have to think about how services will be provided, because a great many people who run restaurants, you know, they say, okay, I can reopen, but how long can I hang on if I've only got 25 or 50% of my customer base coming in, if I can't have a bar? These kinds of things make it, you know, yes, people will hang on for a while, but how long?
Right. And I mean, and then again, the response, there may be a response from government to relax some of the regulations in place right now over that period of time. But it seems to me the real an additional threat that's not perhaps being properly considered is when you talk about people being in dire straits and not appreciating how many people will be and how soon. Then you have the entree of government, and so you have the perspective, like George W. Bush said when he greenlighted TARP and all of the government action that was taken in the 2008 financial crisis, which was to say, if it's a choice between Herbert Hoover and FDR, I want to be FDR, and this president or the next one may make the same decision.
Yes, and actually in April, what happened was very much modeled on TARP, and the system was flushed with cash, and we now have about a 33% savings rate of people, households basically stored up the cash. So there's a really a question of what people are going to do, which goes beyond whether they have the resources, whether middle class households have some money stored up. Are they going to go out and spend it? If I relax the regulations on those restaurants, will people crowd into the bars? I don't think they will. I think we've got to come to grips with the fact that people are going to be very, very cautious, husband their resources very carefully going forward. And what the New Deal did, that was after 4 years, was they said, okay, given that's the case, we've got to start getting activity going, and we have to organize it. And that's really a very different proposition from what happened in April or what happened in what George W. Bush and Barack Obama did in 2008, 2009.
Well, and it seems to me that that realization is dawning on some of the folks around the president, too, because after the $3 trillion phase four stimulus disaster relief, whatever you want to term it, was sort of dismissed that Nancy Pelosi marshaled through the House. Now, President Trump this week talking more about finding ways to get money in the hands of Americans again, something akin to what was previously done.
Well, the more people understand that this is going to require, you know, a new structure, the better. I don't know exactly what that structure is. I'm thinking in terms of cooperative models where there's some profit sharing and some protection of losses. But one has to have, a services sector. One has to have all of these things that we had before. But if they're operating at much lower rates of utilization, there's got to be some protection for them. And you look at models of economies in Asia. I mean, you look at Korea. You look at China or Vietnam, and you look at Singapore. You look at other places. You'll find that this is in fact the case, that there are protections that one does. Have a system where enterprises can go forward and go through difficult periods without disappearing. And this is the difficulty we have now, is that basically the owners of small businesses employ a lot of people saying, well, you know, I think I'll just board it up and walk away because I really can't make it work. That's where we need to think about how to reform the system.
I mentioned it, and then you added to it, talking about the 2008 financial crisis. And are you worried at all that what you're describing could engender another banking crisis?
It potentially could. I don't know what the situation is in U.S. With U.S. banks. I certainly listened to Chairman Powell's remarks on that. People who are looking at European banks, I think, have lots of reasons to worry. And a banking crisis can start anywhere and spread anywhere. So, at some point, we can worry about the effect on the financial system, too. Yes.
He is Professor James K. Galbraith, Professor of Government, Chair in Government and Business Relations at the LBJ School of Public Affairs at the University of Texas at Austin. Professor, thanks so much for your time. Appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Take care.
Listen, the more you'll know. This is the Dan Prof Show.